Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Hi, and welcome to the Lightspeed Magazine Story Podcast. I'm your host, John Joseph Adams. Our story this week is How to Become a Mars Overlord by Catherine M. Valenti. It's read for you by Robin Sachs. Born in the Pacific Northwest in 1979, Miss Valenti is the author of more than a dozen works of fiction and poetry, including Palimpsest, the Orphan's Tale series, and the crowd-funded phenomenon, The Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland in a Ship of Her Own Making. She is the winner of the Tiptree Award, the Mythopoeic Award, the Risling Award, and the Million Writers Award. She was a finalist for the World Fantasy Award in 2007 and 2009, and the Lambda, Andre Norton, and Hugo Awards in 2010. She lives on an island off the coast of Maine with her partner, two dogs, and an enormous cat. Learn more at CatherineMValenti.com. Before we get to the story, here's a brief introduction by the author.
Hi, this is Catherine Valenti, and I'm introducing my story, How to Become a Mars Overlord, in Lightspeed Magazine. The origin of this story is basically, I married a science fiction fan. My husband has for some years been making references to Mars Overlorddom as kind of metaphor for self-actualization in his own life, but also literally being a Mars Overlord, because that's an inherently awesome thing. Being the magpie of ideas I am, I thought there was a story there. There was something bigger there that I could latch onto, because Mars is such a focus, is such a iconic image of old school science fiction and what we once thought the universe would be like when we got out there. With Bradbury and Heinlein and a lot of other writers, I think only the moon is similar in iconic value to science fiction. And the story itself is, in microcosm, a future history of Mars, a Mars that we might have once hoped would be, that we know cannot be anymore, but can still sort of exist in the realms of science fiction. It's only ever existed in science fiction and can only ever continue in science fiction. It is a universe and a world contained completely within science fiction itself, and so is this Mars is kind of science fiction's love child. There are, of course, other planets in the story, planets which are Mars but not Mars, the idea being that every solar system contains a kind of Mars analog. I really like this idea that the universe is sort of narratively unified, that it rhymes or repeats itself the same way a poem does. But the story is also about life on Earth and what Mars really means, what Mars is to each and every one of us, which is kind of a bizarre sort of come to Jesus sort of thing to say, what Mars means to each and every one of us. But at the same time, something cannot be iconic without meaning something different to everybody. And within the confines of the story, not only is Mars a planet and a story and a character, but Mars is us. I am Mars and you are Mars and we are all Mars together. And to be an overlord of that is to be in control of one's own soul. But at the same time, the story really is about what is domination, what is it to be dominated? And are these attractive things, are these desirable things, or is there something unpleasant at the core of that desire in humans? The story really is a love poem to that alternate Mars, the Mars of the mind, much as my story, The Radiant Car Thy Sparrows Drew, that I wrote last year for Clark's World, was about an alternate Venus. This is about that Mars that only ever existed, that we know now can only ever exist in fiction, but dreamed of in reality for an awfully long time. I hope you enjoy it.
Okay, thanks, Kat. I hope you enjoy the story, and if you do, I hope you'll go to our website at lightspeedmagazine.com and leave a comment. Just click on Fiction, find this story, and then leave a comment there. Or, if you'd like to help spread the word, go to iTunes, find the Lightspeed Magazine Story Podcast, and leave a review or rating there. Well, that about does it for this week's intro, so without further ado, let's make the jump to Lightspeed.
How to Become a Mars Overlord by Catherine M. Valente. Welcome, aspiring potentates. We are tremendously gratified at your interest in our little red project and pleased that you recognize the potential growth opportunities inherent in whole planet domination. Of course, we remain humble in the face of such august and powerful interests and seek only to showcase the unique and challenging career paths currently available on the highly desirable, iconic, and oxygen-rich landscape of Mars. Query: why Mars? It is a little-known fact that every solar system contains Mars. Not Mars itself, of course, but certain suns seem to possess what we might call a habit of Martianness. In every inhabited system so far identified, there is a red planet, usually near enough to the most populous world, if not as closely adjacent as our own twinkling scarlet beacon, with proximate lengths of day and night. Even more curious, these planets are without fail named for war divinities. In the far-off lighthouse system, the orb Makar turns slowly in the dark, red as the blood of that fell goddess to whom cruel strategists pray, she who nurses two skulls at each mammoth breast. In the glyph system, closer to home, it is the Firyalai glittering there like a ripe red fruit, called after a god of doomed charges, depicted in several valuable tapestries as a jester dancing ever on the tip of a sword, clutching in each of his seven hands a bouquet of whelk muskets, bones, and promotions with golden seals. In the Birabira system, still yet we may walk the carnelian sands of Upskill, the officer's patron goddess, with her woolly dactyl wings weighted down with gorsuskite medals gleaming purple and white. Around her orbit, Widskill and Nagskill, the enlisted man's god and the pilot's mad, bald angel, soaring pale as twin ghosts through Upskill's emerald-colored sky. Each red planet owns also two moons, just as ours does. Some of them will suffer life to flourish. We have ourselves vacationed on the several crystal ponds of Volney and Vernost, which attend the claret equatorial jungles of Rauder, named, of course, for the four-faced lord of bad intelligence, whose exploits have been collected in the glassily perfect septameters of the Raudrian Eddas. We have flown the lonely black between the satellites on slim-finned ferries, decked in green-glow blossoms, sacred to the poorly informed divine personage. But most moons are kin to Phobos and Deimos, and rotate silently, empty, barren, bright stones, mute and heavy. Many a time we have asked ourselves, does Mars dwell in a house of mirrors? That same red face repeated over and over in the distance, a quantum hiccup. Or is Mars the master, the exemplum, and all the rest copies? Surely the others ask the same riddle. We would all like to claim the primacy of our own specimen, and frequently do, which led to the Astronomers' War some years ago, and truly no one here can bear to recite that tragic narrative, or else we should wash you all away with our rust-stained tears. The advantages of these many Marses, scattered like ruby seeds across the known darkness, are clear. In almost every system, due to stellar circumstances beyond mortal control, Mars or Iskra or Lial is the first best candidate for occupation by the primary world. In every system, the late pre-colonial literature of those primary worlds becomes obsessed with that tantalizing rose-colored neighbor. Surely some of you are here because your young hearts were fired by the bedside tales of Alim Kay, her passionate affair with the two Piscine princes of Red Nisau, and how she waked dread machines in the deep rills of the Knessid Mountains in order to possess them. Who among us never read of the mariner Ubaido and his silver-keeled ship exploring the fell canals of Mikto, their black water filled with eely leviathans whose eyes shone with clusters of green pearls? All your mothers read the ballads of Solahul to each of you in your cribs, and your infant dreams were filled with gorgeous green six-legged cricket queens ululating on the broad pink plains of Podnebesia, their carapaces awash in light. And who did not love Illa, her strange longings against those bronze spires? Who did not thrill to hear of those scarlet worlds bent to a single will? Who did not feel something stir within them, confronted with those endless crimson sands? We have all wanted Mars in our time. She is familiar. She is strange. She is redolent of tales and spices and stones we have never known. She is demure and gives nothing freely, but from our hearths we have watched her glitter all of our lives. Of course we want her. Mars is the girl next door. Her desirability is encoded in your cells. It is archetypal. We absolve you in advance. No matter what system bore you, lifted you up, made you strong and righteous, there is a Mars for you to rule, and it is right that you should wish to rule her. These are perhaps the only certainties granted to a soul like yours. We invite you, therefore, to commit to memory our simple two-step system to accomplish your laudable goals. For obviously no paper, digital, or flash materials ought to be taken away from this meeting. Step 1. Get to Mars. It is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a poor man to get to Mars. However, to be born on a bed of gems leads to a certain laziness of the soul, a kind of muscular weakness of the ambition, a subtle sprain in the noble faculties. Not an original observation, but repetition proves the axiom. Better to excel in some other field, for the well-rounded overlord is a blessing to all. Perhaps microcloning or kinetic engineering. If you must, write a novel, but only before you depart, for novels written in the post-despotic utopia you hope to create may be beloved, but will never be taken seriously by the literati. Take as your exemplum the post-plastic retroviral architect Helix Foe. The Chilean wunderkind was born with ambition in his mouth, and literally stole his education from an upper-class boy he happened upon in a dark alley. In exchange for his life, the patriarch agreed to turn over all his books and assignments upon completion, so that Foe could shadow his university years. For his senior project, Foe locked his erstwhile benefactor in a basement and devoted himself wholly to the construction of the Para-Influenza Opera House in Santiago, whose translucent spires even now dominate that skyline. The wealthy graduate went on to menial labor in the doctoral factories, much chagrined, while young Foe swam in wealth and fame, enough to purchase 3 marriage rights, including one to an aquatic vercoid androgene with an extremely respectable feather ridge. By his 40th birthday, Foe had also purchased, through various companies, the better part of the Atlantic Ocean, whereupon he began breeding the bacterial island which so generously hosts us tonight, and supplies our salads with such exquisite Yersinia radishes. Since, nearly all interplanetary conveyances have launched from Foe's RNA platform, for he charged no tariffs but his own passage, in comfort and grace. You will, of course, remember Foe as the first All-Emperor of Mars, and his statue remains upon the broad Athabasca Vallas. Or, rather, model yourself upon the poetess 19.01 of Moore, who set the glittering world of Moore letters to furious clicking and torsioning of vocabulary bladders. You and I may be quite sure there is no lucre at all to be made in the practice of poetry, but the half-butterfly giants of Moore are hardwired for rhyming structures. They cannot help but speak in couplets, sing their simplest greetings in six-part contratenor harmonies. Moore wars exist only between the chosen bards of each country, who spend years in competitive recitings to settle issues of territory. 19, her lacy wings shot through with black neural braiding, revolted and became a mistress of free verse. Born in the nectar soup of the capital pool, she carefully collected words with no natural rhymes, like dewdrops, hoarding, categorizing, and collating them. As a child, she haunted the berry-dripping speakeasies where the great luminaries read their latest work. At the age of 16, barely past infancy in the long stage shifts of a Moore, she delivered her first poem, which consisted of two words: bright, cellar. Of course, in English, these have many rhymes, but in Moore, they have none, and her poem may as well have been a bomb detonated on the blue floor of that famous nightclub. 19 found the secret unrhyming world hiding within the delicate, gorgeous structures of Moore, and dragged it out to shine in the sun. But she was not satisfied with fame, nor with her mates and grubs and Sweetwater gems. That is how it goes with those of us who answer the call. Alone in a ship of unrhymed glass, she left Moore entirely, and within a year took the red diadem of Etel for her own. Each rival she assassinated died in bliss as she whispered her verses into their perishing ears. It is true that Harlow Y, scion of the House of Y, ruled the red planet Hlim for some time. However, all may admit his rule frayed and frolicked in poor measure, and we have confidence that no one here possesses the makings of a Y hidden away in her jumpsuit. Dominion of the House of Y passed along genetic lines, though this method is degenerate by definition and illegal in most systems. By the time Harlow ascended, generations of Y had been consumed by little more than fashion, public nudity, and the occasional religious fad. What species Y may have belonged to before their massive wealth, derived from mining ore and cosmetics, if the earliest fairy tales of Vit are to be believed, allowed constant and enthusiastic gene manipulation, voluntary mutation, prostheses, and virtual uplink, no one can truly say. Upon the warm, golden sea of Vit, you are House Y, or you are prey, and they have forcibly self-evolved out of recognizability. Harlow himself appears in a third of his royal portraits, something like a massive winged koala with extremely long ultraviolet eyelashes and a crystalline torso. Harlow Y inherited majority control over Hlim as a child and administered it much as a child will do, mining and farming for his amusement and personal augmentation. Each of his ultraviolet lashes represented thousands of dead Hlimi, crushed to death in avalanches in the mine shafts of the Ipo Mountains. But though Harlow achieved overlordship with alacrity and great speed, he ended in assassination. his morning hash tea and bamboon spectacularly poisoned by the general and unanimous vote of the populace. Mastery of Mars is not without its little lessons. It is surely possible to be born on a red planet. The Infanza of Hap lived all her life in the ruby jungles of her homeworld. She was the greatest actress of her age. Her tales could convey the colors of 100 complex emotions in a shimmering fall of shades. So deft were her illusions that the wicked old Ray thought her loyal and gentle beyond words, even as she sunk her bladed fingers into his belly. But we must assume that if you require our guidance, you did not have the luck of a two-tailed Infanza, and were born on some other, meaner world with black soil, or blue storms, or sweet rain falling like ambition denied. Should you be so unfortunate as to originate upon a planet without copious travel options, due to economic crisis, ideological roadblocks, or simply occupying a lamentably primitive place on the technological timeline, have no fear. You are not alone in this. We suggest cryonics. The severed head of Plasticine Bly ruled successfully over the equine hemivores of AOM for a century. He gambled, and gambled hard. He had his brain preserved at the age of 20, hoping against hope that the ice might deliver him into a world more ready for his rarefied soul. Should you visit AOM, the great wall of statues bearing her face, the sculptors kindly gave her a horse body, will speak to what may be grasped when the house pays out. If cryonics is for some reason unpopular on your world, longevity research will be your bosom friend. Invest in it. Nurture it. Only you can be the steward of your own immortality. Even on Earth, Sarai Norte, third Emira of Valles Marineris, managed to outlive her great-grandchildren by funding 6 separate think tanks and an Australian diamond mine, until one underpaid intern presented her upon her birthday with a cascade of injections sparkling like champagne. But on some worlds, in some terrible dark hours, there is no road to Mars, no matter how much the traveling soul might desire it. In patchwork shoes, staring up at a starry night and one gleaming red star among the thousands, sometimes want is not enough. Not enough for Maximilian Bauxbaum, a Jewish baker in Provence, who in his most secret evenings wrote poetry describing such strange blood-colored deserts, such dry canals, a sky like green silk. Down to his children and to theirs and theirs again, he passed a single ruby the size of an egg, the size of a world. The baker had been given it as a bribe by a Christian lord to take his leave of a certain maiden whom he loved, with hair the color of oxide-rich dust and eyes like the space between moons. Never think on her again. Never whisper her name to the walls. Though he kept his promise to an old and bitter death, such a treasure can never be spent, for it is as good as admitting your heart can be bought. Sarai Norte inherited that jewel and brought it with her to bury beneath the foundations of the Cathedral of Olympus Mons. In the end, you must choose a universe that contains yourself and Mars, together and perfect. Helix Vo chose a world built by viruses as tame as songbirds. Orm-19 chose a world gone soft and violet, with unrhyming songs. Make no mistake, every moment is a choice between this world and that one, between heavens teeming with life and a lonely machine grinding across red stone, between staying at home with tea and raspberry cookies and ruling Mars with a hand like grace. Maximilian Bauxbaum chose to keep his promise. Who is to say it is not that promise instead of microbial soup which determined that Mars would be teeming with blue inhuman cities, with 17 native faiths, by the time his child opened her veins to those terrible champagne elixirs and turned her eyes to the night. Step 2. Become an overlord. Now we come to the central question at the core of planetary domination. Just how is it done? The answer is a riddle. Of course, it would be. You must already be an overlord in order to become one. Ask yourself, what is an overlord? Is he a villain? Is she a hero? A cowboy? A priestess? An industrialist? Is he cruel? Is he kind? Does she rule like air, invisible, indispensable? Is she the first human on Mars, walking on a plane so incomprehensible and barren that she feels her heart empty? Does she scratch away the thin red dust and see the black rock beneath? Does he land in his sleek piscine capsule on upskill, so crammed with libraries and granaries that he lives each night in an orgy of books and bread? What does she lord over? The land alone? The people? The belligerent patron gods with their null bronze greaves ablaze? Is it true, as Orm 19 wrote, that the core of each red world is a gem of blood compressed like carbon, a hideous war diamond that yearns toward the strength of a king or a queen as a compass yearns toward north? Or is this only a metaphor, a way in which you can anthropomorphize something so vast as a planet? Think of it as something capable of loving you back. It would seem that the very state of the overlord is one of violence, of domination. Uncomfortable colonial memories arise in the heart like acid. Everyone wants to be righteous. Everyone wishes to be loved. What is any pharaonic statue staring out at a sea of malachite foam but a plea of the pharaoh to be loved forever, unassailably, without argument? Ask yourself, will Mars be big enough to fill the hole in you, the one that howls with such winds, which says the only love sufficient to quiet those winds is the love of a planet, red in tooth, claw, orbit, mass? We spoke before of how to get to Mars if your lonely planet offers no speedy highway through the skies. Truthfully, and now we feel we can be truthful here in the long night of our seminar, when the clicking and clopping of the staff has dimmed and the last of the cane cream has been sopped up, when the stars have all come out and through the crystal ceiling we can all see one, oh, so red, just there, just out of reach. Truthfully, getting to Mars is icing. It is parsley. To be an overlord is to engage in mastery of a bright red thing. Reach out your hand. What in your life, confined to this poor grit, this lone blue world, could not also be called Mars? Rage, cruelty, the god of your passions, the terrible skills you possess, that forced obedience from a fiery engine, bellicose children, lines of perfect, gleaming code. These things, too, are Mars. They are named for fell gods. They spit on civilized governance. And they might, if whipped or begged, fill some nameless void that hamstrings your soul. Mars is everywhere. Every world is Mars. You cannot get there if you are not the lord and leader of your own awful chariot, if you are not the crowned paladin in the car, instead of the animal roped to it, frothing, mad, driven, but never understanding. We have said you must choose, as Bauxbaum and Orm and Foe chose. To choose is to understand your own highest excellence, even if that is only to bake bread and keep promises. You must become great enough here that Mars will accept you. Some are chosen to this life. Mars itself is chosen to it, never once in all its iterations having been ruled by democracy. You may love Mars, but Mars loves a crown, a scepter, a horn-mooned diadem spangled in ice opals. This is how the bride of Mars must be dressed. Make no mistake, no matter your gender, you are the blushing innocent brought to the bed of a mate as ancient and inscrutable as any death's head bridegroom out of myth. Did you think that the planet would bend to your will? That you would control it? Oh, it is a lovely word. Overlord. Emperor. Pharaoh. Princeps. But you will be changed by it as by a virus. Mars will fill your empty, abandoned places. But the greatest of them understood their place. The Overlord embraces the red planet, but in the end, Mars always triumphs. You will wake in your thousand-year reign to discover your hair gone red, your translucent skin covered in dust, your three hearts suddenly fused into a molten, stony core. You will cease to want food and seek out only cold, black air to drink. You will face the sun and turn slowly in circles for days on end. Your thoughts will slow and become grand. You will see as a planet sees, speak as it speaks, which is to say, the long view, the perfected sentence. And one morning you will wake up and your mouth will be covered over in stone, but the land beneath you, crimson as a promise, as a ruby, as an unrhymed couplet, as a virus. The land, or the machine, or the child, or the book, will speak with your voice, and you will be an overlord. And how proud we shall be of you, here by the sea, listening to the dawn break over a new shore.
This has been a production of Lightspeed Magazine in association with Skyboat Road Company, Inc. To subscribe to this podcast, comment on this story, or read additional stories from Lightspeed Magazine, please visit lightspeedmagazine.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.